very much. So I was told that this is a joint meeting of particle physicists and cosmologists. What I'm going to talk about has nothing to do with either topic, so it's probably very appropriate. So some of you may have noticed that last year, first half of last year, there was a lot of publicity in science, but also in Nature, about evidence that had recently been uncovered for a supernova explosion, which deposited radioactive isotopes on Earth. And this actually, I think, would be the first evidence for a direct impact on Earth of a specific astrophysical event. So I want to tell you a little bit the story of this. So this has actually been a hobby of mine, which goes back just over 20 years ago now. And specifically in a paper with the late Dave Schramm and his then student Brian Fields back in 1996, we proposed looking for short-lived nuclear isotopes as a possible signature of such a nearby supernova explosion. And concretely, what happened last year was that a whole array of new data came out indicating a layer of iron-60. So this is an isotope of iron which is unstable with a half-life of about 2.5 million years, which would have been deposited on Earth by a nearby supernova explosion about 2.5 million years ago. So I want to give you the background to that story and describe a little bit the experimental work, our theoretical work, and an update on the most recent theoretical paper that we wrote last year. Okay, so to start off with a little bit of background. So here you have one of the standard nuclear isotope tables, which in this instance is color-coded according to what we think are the origins of those elements. So what is written here is exploding massive stars. You can translate that into physics language as being supernovae. So of course the commonest element in Earth is iron. And so there it is, a big peak in the element distribution. And here is iron. And as you can see, the origin of iron on Earth is believed to be a mixture of supernova explosions and exploding white dwarfs. Now, I come back to one or two other features of this later on. In particular, if I can find... No, I can't find plutonium. Plutonium is an interesting case that I'll come back to on a couple of occasions later. Okay, so where do these supernova explosions take place? So this is a simulation of the distances from Earth of 10 to the fifth supernovae just generated statistically with the distribution of stars in our galaxy. So roughly speaking, people think that there have been something like 10 to the eight supernovae in our galaxy since it got started. So this is actually a very small subsample. Now, there's long been discussion of the potential implications for life on Earth of a nearby supernova explosion, and I'll describe some of that in a moment. I think there's general consensus that a supernova within about 10 parsecs could have caused or would cause a mass extinction. Radiation, destruction of the ozone layer, etc., etc. And if you go through the numbers, then you would expect that such an event might occur on average once every few 100 million years. So the tail of this distribution here, unfortunately, doesn't have enough events to really justify that, but that's what the calculation gives you. So this is just a little bit more about the galactic supernova rate. So it's normalized here to a distance of 30 parsecs, which is a little bit beyond the kill radius, but that's the sort of distance that we're going to be talking about later on in this presentation. So what this is telling you is that, roughly speaking, once every 10 million years or so, you might see a supernova something like 30 parsecs away. And as it says here, we would have expected multiple events within 10 parsecs in the last 4.5 giga-years since the Earth was created.
Very roughly, what's the mechanism that would lead to the mass extinction event? What actually happens to the kill scenes?
I'll discuss that in a moment. Okay. So anyway, this is a histogram of rates of extinction as extracted from the fossil record going back over the last 500 million years or so ago. What's interesting about this is that it's certainly not smooth. It exhibits a whole range of peaks. And of course, the most recent prominent peak occurred 66 or 67 million years ago when the dinosaurs were wiped out. But as you can see from this is just one of many mass extinction events in Earth's history. In particular, there's this one about 250 million years ago at the end of the Permian, which was probably the biggest one, with something like 95% of living species getting wiped out.
Sorry, what's the one after the dinosaurs?
Sorry?
What's the one after the dinosaurs?
I must confess, I don't know. This is not such a big mass extinction, but... Okay, so this is an artist's impression of what happened when the dinosaurs got wiped out. And as you presumably all know, it was Alvarez, Asaro, and Michel who in 1980 identified an impact on Earth of an asteroid as a possible origin of the demise of the dinosaurs. But what's actually perhaps less well known is that they set out by looking for evidence of a supernova explosion. And of course, they found this iridium layer. They also looked for other signatures of a nearby supernova explosion. And one of the things that they expected to see was plutonium-244. So, of course, nowadays you find in the environment anthropogenic plutonium-244, but it could also be deposited on Earth by some sort of astrophysical event. So they didn't find plutonium-244, and that was one of the main reasons why they concluded that the iridium layer that they had found was actually not due to a supernova explosion. Actually, current thinking is that supernova explosions do not form plutonium-244. It's actually thought nowadays, and I'll return to that later on, that plutonium-244 would originate from mergers of neutron stars. So it's not clear whether the basis on which Alvarez et al. Reached their conclusion was actually correct, but of course the conclusion was correct. And we now know that there was an asteroid impact just on the coast of the Yucatan Peninsula, and this, we believe, was at least heavily implicated in the demise of the dinosaurs, although there's still some discussion about whether that was the only cause or whether there were also other contributing factors. Anyway, I like to think that this story indicates that ignorance is dangerous. We should keep a watch out for astrophysical events because one of these days, one might come along and try to hit us. Okay, so I said that just over 20 years ago now, I got interested in the subject with the late Dave Schramm. And I've been working with Dave Schramm on the sort of constraints we get on particle properties from supernova explosions. And then somehow or other, we got interested in this old story about possible mass extinctions coming from a supernova explosion. And we actually considered three possible effects. So there was the initial flash of gamma rays, the fact that you get an increased flux of cosmic rays for some period of time, and the possibility that you get a deposition of dust. So obviously, if you actually looked at the supernova, your eyeballs would get wiped out. But if you didn't look at it, then we concluded this was not necessarily a big problem. So we estimated the increased flux of cosmic rays, both neutral and charged cosmic rays. And it's interesting to compare these fluxes with the usual cosmic ray flux. And so if you're at a distance of the order of 10 parsecs, then you see that you get a substantial increase in the cosmic ray flux for some period of time. So if I put in 10 parsecs, this would correspond to a period of 300 years. So we considered what these cosmic rays would do to the ionosphere. And in particular, we argued that they would destroy the ozone layer. So some period of time, which you could variously estimate, maybe thousands of years, the ozone layer would not be protecting us. And this was what we identified as being the most dangerous thing for life on Earth. As for deposition of dust, this is thought to be relatively unimportant. It would have a small effect on the solar constant, the amount of sunlight hitting the Earth. So we didn't think that was important. On the other hand, we did start thinking, well, okay, maybe there's not enough dust to cause us harm, but maybe there will be some observable signature from the dust which was sent our way by such a thing. So that led to a follow-up paper that Dave and I wrote with Brian Fields, where we suggested looking for radioactive rain. So we thought, well, okay, let's open up the discussion to supernovae which are somewhat further away, within, let's say, 100 parsecs, where you get orders of magnitude more supernovae, which occur, as I said, we're talking about 30 parsecs, typically once every few million years or so. So these would be far enough away that they wouldn't cause a mass extinction. On the other hand, they might have deposited on Earth a layer of unstable nuclear isotopes that could be detected in dedicated experiments. So, of course, since the Earth was formed 4.5 million year, billion years ago, any isotope which has a lifetime in the range of a few million years would have to have been deposited on Earth by some sort of astrophysical event. So that was the smoking gun that we proposed for a recent, relatively nearby supernova. Okay, so just a little bit about supernova explosions, particular attention to iron-60, which is the main isotope of interest in the rest of this talk. So here you have...
Can you make iron-60 from radioactive decay or anything else?
Not that I know. No.
Okay.
No. Anyway, as I'm going to report, on Earth we see a thin layer of iron-60. So it clearly comes from some very specific origin. Okay, so here's a typical star in the late stage of evolution. So of course, it starts off by burning up hydrogen, and then it progresses through heavier and heavier elements until eventually it reaches iron. Of course, when it reaches iron, it can no longer produce energy by fusion, and at that point the core collapses and gravitational energy is released in the form of the supernova explosion that we see. So it's a corollary of this that in this final stage of evolution you've got a whole bunch of iron, and not all of it is going to be iron 56, some of it is going to be iron 60. And I'm going to be showing you some more calculations later on also of different isotopes. But just to sort of orient ourselves a little bit, this is from a calculation, or a couple of calculations some years ago, of the amount of iron-60 that could have been produced by a supernova explosion. And here, various different progenitor masses are considered. What you see is the amount of iron 60 that you produce certainly depends on the mass of the progenitor star. What you also see is that it depends on who's doing the simulation. So there are some uncertainties in this, obviously. But nevertheless, iron 60 looks like it's going to be a very plausible signature for such an explosion. But it's actually in our paper, we considered a whole bunch of different isotopes with lifetimes less than a few hundred million years, ranging from beryllium 10 to iron, obviously, all the way up to plutonium 244. Now, I should perhaps mention that around the time when we wrote our paper, there were reports of anomalies in beryllium 10. In ice cores, which would date to about 35-60 kilo years ago. That was perhaps one of the reasons why we thought about this, but I don't think we actually believe that that was a specific astrophysical event. Anyway, we considered looking not just at ice cores, give you a look back time measured in hundreds of thousands of years, but also deep ocean sediments, which give you a look back time extending millions of years. So just one little remark. When I talk about isotopes being produced by supernovae and reaching Earth, there's actually two ways in which this can happen. One of which is where the supernova produces a shock and the shock hits us. And the other one is where there was a supernova explosion whose shockwave stalled, and then the Earth moves through the stalled shock front. So either shock hits us or we hit the shock, if you see what I mean.
The shock doesn't actually carry things. So you think whether contact is continuity or something, because shock is just something that propagates. It's a wave that propagates. It doesn't actually carry stuff.
Well, it does carry stuff. And I'll show you a typical profile that we calculated for the iron 60 in such a shockwave a little bit later on.
Okay, so I would say that's the contact discontinuity, not the shock.
Sorry?
That would be the contact discontinuity that would, that carries material. But yeah.
Now, of course, there are other ways in which you could produce light isotopes. And in fact, you mentioned already one of them, possibly through radioactive decays. Another thing is cosmogenic background. This particular problem for light isotopes, like beryllium 10, which can be produced by spallation from the cosmic ray collision. So anyway, we did calculations in our paper for a supernova at a nominal distance of 20 parsecs. And this is a table taken from our paper. So here's a bunch of different isotopes. So there's a signal over here on the left-hand side, there's a background here over on the right-hand side. So if we look at iron, we concluded that the backgrounds would be way smaller than what you might get from a supernova explosion. Good question. I'm afraid I can't answer that question. I'm just interested in the relative numbers. Well, we did calculate the absolute flux, but here I'm mainly focusing just on the relative numbers.
And what was wrong with things like that? It's calcium and CA.
Sorry?
The CA and MN, those also have a large signal to background ratio.
Right.
What's the advantage of the iron?
So I will discuss a bit the various different elements in a moment. Okay, so perhaps you could hold that question for a bit. But I just wanted to draw your attention to the fact that, for example, if you're looking at beryllium 10, then we didn't think that a signal would stick up above the background. Also, aluminium doesn't have a very favorable signal to background, not as favorable as iron. But one of the advantages of iron is that there are specific sediments that concentrate iron, and those are ones, therefore, that you can look at. Okay, But I don't know whether anybody has seen this rather bad B movie. So the thesis is that the Nazis established a base on the far side of the moon, and they return. Anyway, what I want to discuss is the first evidence for iron 60. So this came from measurements by a group from the Technical University of Munich using accelerator mass spectrometry. And they specifically analyzed things at the bottom of the ocean called ferromanganese crusts, which concentrate iron and manganese, as you might expect. They also look more generally at deep ocean sediments. But these ferromanganese crusts are an example of what I mean. This is a specific layer where specific type of mineral that contains a large abundance of iron. So here is a typical piece of ferromanganese crust with a coin. I don't know what the coin is. And this is a typical piece of deep ocean sediment with a couple of typical fingers. Okay, so these are the data that were published in the original Munich paper. So this is the look-back time. As you can see here, the time resolution was not very precise. What they reported was an excess of iron 60, indicated by these horizontal bars here. Okay, so this answers your question about the flux. So this is in units per square centimeter per mega year. And what you see in particular was that there was an excess deposited during the last 5 million years, and the strongest signal was actually in this time frame over the last 3 million years. So this paper was published in 1999, and we were certainly very gratified to see the signal. But of course, you know, the data weren't particularly good. In particular, the time resolution wasn't very nice. So we and others, I think, wanted to see more evidence to confirm the existence of the signal.
Can you explain a bit more the plot? Because it's confusing. The horizontal axis is the age, zero is the day, I would imagine.
Yeah.
So that means that 10 mega years ago, we had more flux of iron 60.
Okay, so what you see here is that the signal, if there is one at that time, is completely compatible with the background. Now remember that the lifetime of iron 60 is about 2.5 million years. So that explains why, you know, the error bar is very large, because you're talking about a very small number of events. Most of them would have decayed if there had been some from 10 million years ago. And the small number that you see is completely consistent with background.
Okay. But the flux that they observe say that it looks like the background estimate drops suddenly at 6. Or 4.
Four.
Yeah, yeah. Four. 6 and then 4. So why is the flux becoming smaller as we go towards today?
So as I said, your sensitivity to an unstable isotope decreases as you look further and further back in time.
Right. Sure, but the background estimate does not depend on any error bars. So the estimate, the background level that appears
But the background would also be genuine iron 60. Perhaps this will be clearer on the next one.
Like, this is something that exponentially rises, the background, is that, I assume, that's
this is flux, right? It's centimeters per mega year. This is flux, the positive.
I think this is not there because there's an exponential multiplier, right? Otherwise, it would be a constant. So.
Right, so this is the next. Right. So you should actually unfold the exponential decay of iron 60, which has not been done here. Okay. And so they measure, if you like, an amount of iron 60 in the sediment, which would correspond to a flux which would have been exponentially enhanced. So why don't we look at this plot here? So here, they've got a subsequent paper a few years later. So now they've got much more precise information. And you see that there is always some background level. But in this case, they have corrected for the lifetime. Okay? So you see there's always some background level. But what you also see is that there's a very clear peak, which corresponds to a look-back time of about 2.5, 3 million years.
Could you say again, how are they measuring the look-back time? How do they...
Yeah. Well, basically, you just look at the depth. So you got your chip of ferromanganese crust, and you slice it carefully according to depth, and then you look to see what is the iron 60 count in each layer.
Different
places.
Right. I guess I'm confused where the background, can you say again where the background is coming from? I think you had it in the table, but other than from these supernova events, this is supposed to be some thing that was deposited a long time ago and is slowly decaying, or there's some
sort of... Sorry, I must confess I'm not a real expert on what are the dominant sources of the background. But I think the sort of things that you were mentioning, you know, radioactive decay, some of them will produce some iron 60 at some level. Okay, so what would be the interpretation of this signal? So one of the things that we did was to calculate the expected time structure. And so this comes back to your question a moment ago. And so these are the time structures that we would expect for deposits by these different types of astrophysical source. So what you typically see is a peak, which is followed by a tail, which is due to straggling behind the shock wave or whatever you want to call it. So what you see is that the typical width of this is, let's say, 100,000 years, maybe 200,000 years. But you certainly would expect to see a non-trivial time structure, and that time structure would be, let's say, short compared to 500,000 years. So here we compare some of the time structures that we calculated with the data from the peak that I showed you two slides back. And also there was another paper by Petrucci et al. These are all by the Munich group. So the earlier data that I showed you, those are the black circles. The other ones are the open squares. You can see that they're sort of, roughly speaking, consistent, although you know you might argue about the details of the shape of the peak. Anyway, the data which they have, I think one can say, are sort of broadly compatible with what you would have expected from the sort of time structure from a recent nearby supernova explosion. Yes.
So two questions. What is the Kamli sigma? If you associate a sigma with the peak, or the pulse detection probability?
Right. So let's see. Well, here's a typical data point here. This looks to me, I know.
I mean, I guess you're part of the physics. It was a resonance. I would just say, why was it's not a 5 sigma? Right?
Yeah, I don't think it's a 5 sigma.
Okay.
I give it, you know, maybe 4 sigma. Okay.
I think it's 4 sigma. Right?
Yeah. And this is one of the reasons why people were not convinced about this until relatively recently. So I think that, you know, many people regarded this evidence from the Munich group as being suggestive, but not conclusive. Okay, so we thought a bit about what might be signals that you can see for other isotopes that would confirm our interpretation. So here we have manganese, we have aluminium, we've got plutonium sitting down the bottom here. And as I mentioned before, one of the uncertainties in this business is that different supernova modelers tend to get different fluxes. They've got the same sort of basic hierarchy, but the normalizations are somewhat different. And you also see that the yields depend on what the mass is of the progenitor. Anyway, one of the things that you see from this is that aluminium looked like it might be a good thing to look for. It might stick up well above background. Manganese maybe also. So these are more detailed calculations from one of our papers. Lots and lots of numbers. Here's iron. So these calculations here, we show them for various different possible progenitors. So these here are relatively heavy core collapse supernovae. And this is a relatively low mass object called an electron capture supernova, where what happens is, well, as it says, the electrons get captured by nuclei. And this is what actually causes the collapse of the core. So
are you assuming a distance, but you don't mention about the distance as well?
Yeah, so we assume a sort of fiducial distance of 20 parsecs. So for future reference, let me just focus on the case of an electron capture supernova. So you see that an electron capture supernova actually produces relatively little aluminium and manganese compared to these core collapse supernovae. On the other hand, it yields comparable amounts within the uncertainties of iron. So potentially looking for these other isotopes is a diagnostic tool where you could discriminate what type of supernova actually produce your iron layer. So we would have loved to have seen confirmatory signal in some other isotope, but this has not been seen. So here's our calculation of the deposition profile for manganese, and the data show no such peak. The data also show no such peak for aluminium 26, but actually this would be expected under the hypothesis of an electron capture supernova. So this actually is a bunch of calculations for various different low mass progenitors, and they all have this common feature that they don't produce a lot of aluminium 26 or of manganese 53. So if this interpretation is correct, it would have to have been a relatively low mass progenitor. How far away would this thing have been? So based on the observed iron 60 flux, you can infer, depending on the mass of the supernova, the type of supernova that you're talking about, you can infer how far away it would have had to be. And so typical calculation is in the range of 50 to 100 parsecs. So this is well beyond the kill radius of the order of 10 parsecs that I mentioned early on, which is, of course, necessary for consistency. Okay? And if I take particular the favored case of an electron capture supernova, the type that does not produce aluminium and manganese, then you've got a distance somewhere around 50 to 100 parsecs. Okay. So what I've described up until now is the situation as it was before last year. And then last year, there were all these new data which confirmed the previous indications and I think really firmed up in people's minds this idea. So first paper I want to mention is one by Valner et al. From the Australian National University. So what you see here is the locations of the deep ocean samples that we use in previous studies. Those are outlined in red, and the new ones that were studied by Valno et al. So by now, there's samples under all the world's major oceans. And since these guys are working in Australia, it's no surprise that they took a particularly large number of samples just off the coast of Western Australia. And I'll come back to that in a moment. So this is a plot taken from the paper by Valno et al. So they actually took different types of samples. They took a couple of samples from these ferromanganese crusts that I was talking about earlier on. And they also looked at deep ocean sediments, which are these little black stars. So what you see here in this inset are the data from the deep ocean sediments, which give you a pretty clear peak. Over here, you see the signals from the different types of ferromanganese crust. So the data from the red one are pretty crummy, so to speak. The ones from the orange crust are somewhat better, although you will notice that though it looked like there's an offset between the dating from this ferromanganese crust and the dating from the deep ocean sediments. And if you look in the paper by Valno et al., there's a discussion of this, and in particular, there's some, they think, systematic problems with the dating procedure that they use, and they think that there's an uncertainty in this peak here, which is of the order of 500,000 years. Anyway, looking at this, you would say, again, there's very clear evidence for a supernova about 2.5 million years ago. The paper where these data are taken from actually goes further than that and claims evidence for more than one supernova. They claim that the breadth of this peak is such that you need more than one supernova to fit it, and they also thought that they saw an excess in this time frame about 7 or 8 million years ago. So if you didn't think that the previous data were 5 sigma, I think you're certainly not going to think that that data point is 5 sigma. And I'm not sure that you would be convinced that this time structure is evidence for more than one supernova. But anyway, this was the claim that was published in their paper. Anyway, looking at this, I think that you would have to conclude that, you know, there is by now a 5 sigma signal. Okay, so just for the record, this is a table taken from the Valno et al. Paper, which shows the background and decay corrected iron 60 signal. And you know, you can play with it yourself and decide how many sigma you believe this is, and whether there's statistical evidence there for more than one supernova or not. This compares various different samples. I'm not going to go through this in detail. This is just to convince you that the data is there if you want to go away and have a look at it.
Can one use these to predict some directionality or not?
I'm going to come to this in a moment. Now, a lot of the interest last year was generated by a paper that appeared at the same time by Breitschwert et al., where they modeled the local bubble. As you may know, the interstellar medium in the neighborhood of the Earth is not homogeneous, and there's evidence that in the past there have been quite a number of different supernova explosions which have partially evacuated the neighborhood of the Earth, and this was what was discussed in detail in this paper here. So, as you can see here, in order to fit the local bubble, they required as many as 16 supernovae. And they claim that in order to fit the data, that they required more than one supernova in order to explain the width. I remind you that any individual supernova, you would expect to give a signal with a width which is at most maybe 200,000 years. Personally, I'm not convinced by this. And one of the things that Brian Fields and I are trying to do at the moment with a couple of his new students is to actually try to do a statistical analysis.
Just to talk about length scales for a second, it's my understanding that when people are doing these studies, they think about like the local 100 parsecs or so that these 16 supernova look up. Does that sound about right? So that maybe that would be consistent with just one 5 meters per parsec.
Right. So I will discuss in more detail in a moment where these supernovae might have taken place. So as I said, I personally don't believe there's any statistically significant events for more than two. Okay, so that was the second element in the sort of pulse of interest last year. Then there was a third element, which was a report by the Munich people who did an AMS analysis of Apollo lunar rock samples. So here is an astronaut gathering one of these samples. And here's a compilation of the results, again, taken from this paper. So I remind you that there doesn't seem to be any excess of manganese. So what they basically did was to use manganese as a sort of a background estimator. And what they looked for was an excess of iron 60 relative to manganese. So some of these samples you don't see an excess, but some of them you do. And these excesses here look quite significant. Of course, there's no timing information. These are just samples basically taken off the surface or close to the surface of the moon.
And they're all samples that were extracted close by, or they are at different places?
Hang on to the question.
Okay.
You're asking all the right questions. Now, one comment that I would make is that of these astronauts, only one was a trained geologist. So that means that the way in which the samples were taken might be somewhat haphazard, that an astronaut might have said, well, okay, that bit there looks interesting, so I'll take that. So I think very little information can be extracted from this, and we certainly hope that somebody will send some thing back to the moon to get more lunar rock samples in the future. I'm looking at the Chinese and the Indians at this point. And then there was a fourth paper, which I find one of the most amusing ones. So again, this is from the Munich people, and they found evidence for iron 60 in microfossils associated with magnetotactic bacteria. So as you may or possibly may not know, there are some bacteria that secrete crystals, magnetic crystals, so that they can follow magnetic field lines. And in that way, they follow the line until they get to the surface layer where they like to live. Remember that they're living in deep ocean sediments. They don't have many ways of navigating. So what they do is they go along magnetic field lines, and they secrete magnetite crystals. So this is a typical picture of some of those magnetite crystals. And they have kindly done the job of secreting iron. So now we can look in that iron to see whether any of it is iron 60. So they looked in two sediment samples from the Pacific Ocean, and they found a nice peak here, and a nice peak, well, not so nice peak here anyway, some evidence of a peak. For some reason, they put these two plots one above the other, but they didn't use the same horizontal scale. So I've taken the liberty of changing the horizontal scale, so that now they sit on top of each other, and you can see that these two samples seem to be telling the same story. And this look-back time is consistent within errors with what we saw from the previous ferromanganese crust and deep ocean sediments. Okay, so lots of positive signals for iron 60, no evidence for any aluminium 26 or manganese 53. How about plutonium 244? So there's another paper by Valner et al., which actually appeared back in 2015, where they looked for plutonium 244 that might have been deposited on the Earth either by supernova explosions or by neutron star mergers. So you expect a relatively large number of supernova explosions, but each one would only deposit a small amount of material on Earth. You might expect relatively few neutron star mergers, but when one of these takes place, it launches a much larger amount of crud into the interstellar medium. So the difference is sort of a regular drizzle of supernovae or the occasional deluge from an individual neutron star. Now, what they found was that the amount of plutonium 244 in deep ocean sediments was less than what you would have expected from this continuous drizzle. So here is the supernova expectation, and this is what they actually saw. So the interpretation of this would be that plutonium, along with other R-process nuclei, is produced in sites which are relatively few and far between. So the time separation between neutron star mergers would typically be maybe of the order of hundreds of millions of years, and in that time, plutonium 244, which has a half-life of 81 million years, would have a chance to decay. But if this is correct, supernovae did not produce plutonium 244. And the original reason that Alvarez et al. Gave for interpreting their discovery as an asteroid impact, in fact, was wrong. Of course, as I said, conclusion, nobody's challenging that. But the reasoning, however, maybe was not correct. And there's independent evidence that our process nuclear synthesis does not take place in supernovae. And if you remember the nuclei chart that I showed way back at the beginning, the heavy elements were shown as not coming from supernova explosions, but coming from neutron star mergers. Okay, so where was this supernova? Where did this iron 60 come from? So now I'll discuss some work that we did last year looking into this question. So actually, in the neighborhood of the Earth, there are a couple of clusters or associations of stars which have been identified as possible sources. So one is the so-called Scorpio-Centaurus Association, or SCO-CEN, and the other one is the Tucana Horologium Association, known as HUC-4. So these associations are at rather different distances. So if you want to try to figure out which one might have been the host of our supernova, you have to ask yourself, well, how far away would our supernova have had to be? So I remind you that I argued previously that this thing was more likely to be an electron capture supernova. And according to the calculations that we use, that would fit the data if it was, let's say, around 40 to 50 parsecs away. That gives you a much better fit to the HUC-4 association than to the SCO-CEN association. So you might question whether our identification as being electron-captain supernova was correct. But all these possible progenitor masses give you a similar conclusion of the fit to Tuck Hoare is better than the fit to Sco-Sen. So then you might ask yourself, well, is it possible to do radioactive iron astronomy? It was your question a moment ago. So in our paper, Brian Field's student, Brian Fry, tracked dust trajectories through the heliosphere. So here you see typical dust trajectories. Basically, the directionality of the dust is retained until they reach the Earth, although after they go past the Earth and Sun, then they can be scattered. Then once you got it through the heliosphere, you then track it through the magnetosphere. So this typically has less bending power than the magnetosphere, and indeed you see that the directionality is retained also after the dust passes by Earth. So at this stage, we were relatively optimistic that in fact you could get some sort of a hint, not very precise directionality, but at least you might be able to distinguish between Tuck Hoare and Sco-Sen on the basis of the deposition. Unfortunately, this is not the case, because when this stuff arrives in the upper atmosphere, it then gets scattered in latitude, in particular by stratospheric winds. And when it gets further down, it also gets moved around by ocean currents before finally reaching the ocean floor. So one of the reasons why you know this is true is that people have analyzed a plume from space shuttle launches, and they've discovered that relatively rapidly this plume is spread over a large range of latitudes. Okay, so let's come back to this picture here. So this shows you where in the deep ocean samples excesses were found. And this shows you the intensity map that we would get after including the effect of stratospheric winds. So it turns out that it gets blown up to high and low latitudes. So this is bad if you're looking in the Pacific, but not so bad if you're looking up here at very high latitudes or down here at relatively low latitudes. Then you have to look at what the ocean currents might do to it. And again, in the Pacific, it's sort of kind of bad news because the ocean currents just sweep the thing elsewhere. What's interesting is the situation off the coast of Western Australia, where, as you can see, various currents collide. And so this is an area where the ocean water apparently spends more time churning. And so there's a possibility that you might get a higher deposition rate there. However, I think that there's so much mixing done by winds and by ocean currents that it's going to be very difficult to do radioactive iron astronomy with the Earth deposition. But the moon is a different story. On the moon, you don't have any winds, you don't have any oceans. Of course, the signal will be spread out in longitude because the deposition time is much longer than the rotation period of the moon. So here, I show what you might expect to be the intensities of deposition from Sco-Sen and from Tuck Hoare. So you see that these depositions are rather different. They share some similarities, but they are potentially distinguishable. So then we come to the question of where were the samples taken? And so these are the locations. So unfortunately for us, the astronauts wanted to get back to Earth. And because they wanted to get back to Earth, most of the landing sites are close to the lunar equator, so that if there was any problem, they could quickly rejoin the orbiting module. So eventually, they got a little bit more adventurous, and they went to a couple of locations which are away from the lunar equator. But we don't have, if you like, a good lever arm on those different landing sites. So here in blue, you have the latitude profile that we calculate for SEN, green, the one for Tuck Hoare, and these are the data. And so as you can see, you've got big statistical uncertainties, you've got a limited range of latitudes, and there's also this problem that these guys weren't professional geologists who would take the samples under controlled geological protocols. So I don't think that one can infer anything from this, but as I said, in principle, in the future, maybe you could. And again, I return to the suggestion that our friends, the Indians and the Chinese, if they send sample return missions to the moon, would they please go to the poles? Sorry?
Do they need manned missions?
No, it could be a robot mission.
Yeah.
Hasn't there been some analysis on Mars and both near the poles and the equator?
I haven't come across any relevant data from Mars.
I don't know this, but this is
a lot. But I think on Mars they're so much focused on looking for evidence of life. I don't think they thought about this.
So how come we're not yet about the Kakarin trajectories of dust? Because, I mean, these could be charged, or when they be charged with dust particles, and then they would be detected by the magnetic field. So I'm not sure, how clear this calculation is, or how straightforward this calculation is.
Right. So what I presented was calculation of the deflection in the magnetic fields in the solar system. Mm. You could also ask about deflection on the way from the supernova to us.
Yeah.
And the trajectory could be quite complicated. And the student, Brian Fry, was supposed to be calculating it, but then he got his PhD and he went back to he was actually on leave of absence from the US Air Force.
Okay.
So he went back to making real explosions.
Okay.
So I can't answer your question. So, I'm almost out of time, but I just wanted to go back to cosmic rays for a moment. So, there was an interesting analysis of iron 60 in cosmic rays that also appeared last year. So, here, various different elements. You can see iron. If you look carefully, you can see iron comes in different isotopes, including our friend iron 60. So the amount of iron 60 seen in the cosmic rays, I think this may be compatible with what we were talking about earlier on. According to us, that would be independent evidence for relatively recent supernovae within the last few million years. But of course, it's not evidence for a direct impact on Earth. So interestingly, there was a paper a couple of years ago by Kakaris and collaborators who analyzed the spectra of cosmic ray protons, positrons, and antiprotons. And they claimed that there were excesses in these spectra that they could explain in terms of a nearby source of cosmic rays about 2 million years ago. I just mentioned this for completeness. I don't have any deep insight into whether this claim is justified or not. I'd also like to mention this paper that appeared a few months ago by Thomas et al., where they revisited this question of the cosmic ray flux. And so their calculations of cosmic ray flux from a nearby supernova explosion are roughly compatible with the ones that we did a couple of decades previously. Their main interest was to argue that these might give you an enhanced mutation rate. I'm personally very skeptical about that, but there is one relevant piece of data, namely people have looked at mutation rates in bird fossils. So you can date the fossils, and then you can look at the shift in the DNA. And what they claim is that there is a discrepancy between the DNA age and the fossil age. Well, you could draw almost any line through those data. And I'm sure if you're looking for a five sigma effect, you wouldn't see it there. Anyway, this their fit has an intercept here, which is way bigger than any reasonable estimate based on cosmic rays. But I think this is going to be very difficult to find a signal of that type.
When you say the fossil age, I mean that's coming from some isotope dating, whereas the DNA age is coming from imagining that mutations take place.
I'm afraid I don't know the details of how they determine the fossil age. Okay, anyway, that brings me to the end of my story. So I would claim that this observation of iron 60 on ocean floors is the first discovery of an impact upon Earth of a specific astrophysical event. So if you think back to Alvarez et al., the first evidence for a specific impact on Earth of a specific asteroid, which may well have caused a mass extinction. This would not have caused a mass extinction. But it would be the first example of an interstellar astrophysical event. There's some evidence also in lunar samples, some evidence also in cosmic rays. As I said, it's no threat to life on Earth. An interesting question is how you might look for a previous supernova explosion that might have caused a mass extinction. So I remind you here, you're talking about look-back times measured in the hundreds of millions of years, and so you would need to look for an excess of some isotope with a lifetime in that range. And there's actually one excellent example, which is uranium-235. So uranium-235 has a half-life of about 700 million years. As you know, the abundance of 235 on Earth relative to 238 is about 0.7%. That's just because of the radioactive decay of 235. When the Earth was formed, there would have been comparable amounts. So if you found any excess of uranium-235, that will be evidence for some supernova.
Why supernova? Because you have to create this very high element. Would you say it's a binary star merger, perhaps?
Right. Perhaps better a supernova, better a neutron star merger. Anyway, that would be an interesting way to look for some event that might have impacted life on Earth. That's a better way of stating it. So, not for publication. We did actually. I discussed this with a geologist I met at a conference in Morocco, who is an expert on the extinction at the end of the Permian, who had a lot of rock samples from that layer. And so he went away and looked at them, and he found an excess of 235. He found an abundance relative to 238 of about 3%, in which case Brian Fields and I had said, roughly speaking, holy shit, because of those of you who follow the negotiations with the Iranians will know that 3%, that's the abundance of 235, which you can use to feed nuclear reactors. And the experts on proliferation will tell you that if you've got 3%, getting 20% and getting weapons-grade uranium is trivial. So Brian and I were rather skeptical about this. Nevertheless, our geological friend informed a colleague of his who worked for some agency in Washington. And the guy in Washington said, quite reasonably, let's just wait a bit to see whether the signal gets confirmed. You see, our vision was of all these jihadis wandering around. Because I should say, this layer, you can find it in Pakistan, you can find it in Iran, lots of places. Right? So I had this vision of these jihadis wandering around with spades and digging up enriched uranium. Anyway, eventually, we got this sample into an accelerated mass spectrometer, and the answer came back 0.7%. So our geological friends have been using gamma ray spectroscopy, which is notoriously less reliable. So you can sleep well at night. The jihadis are not going to get their hands on enriched uranium, at least not that way. Okay, that's the end of my talk. Hi.
I have a simple-minded question. Why can't it be iron sediments in the earth for reasons other than supernova explosions?
Why couldn't you get it in some other way?
How do you quantify the fact that there can be iron sediments in the earth and those that come from supernova explosions? Maybe this is already been covered.
Yeah, so it would have had to be in some specific event because you get a very specific layer, and the abundance of iron 60 found in that layer is compatible with a supernova calculation if the supernova is of the order of, let's say, 50 to 100 parsecs. So I agree this is sort of circumstantial evidence, and that's why we wanted to look for other elements. And I mentioned aluminium, manganese, and plutonium. Unfortunately, none of those indicate a corroborating signal. But nobody's come up with another interpretation of this signal.
So, iron
60
decays away in millions of years. So, in order to have a large fraction of your iron at any given age, large part iron 60, you have to have some source. So, it's just a normal deposition from.
Right.
So the time you had, I forgot, is it 5 million years? That when do you think the supernova went off? What?
So the layer would have been deposited on Earth about 2.5 million years ago. And the travel time is relatively small. So certainly within the last 3 million years. Yeah.
So in the case of this thing, as a iron core collapse supernova, it becomes a pulsar. Then the kick velocity takes that pulsar way out of the way over 2.5 million years. But if it's an electron capture, like you mentioned, then the kick velocity is very small and the pulsar should still be local. Has there been any ideas to look for candidate pulsars?
But it wouldn't be pulsating after.
So, there's one ATNF catalog source that is 2.4 mega years old and is 100 parsecs away right now. Those age uncertainties are all factors of two because spin down characteristic ages are hard. There's 2.4 mega years of 4 mega years in something like that, and I didn't know if we had tested any of those associations.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that information. I mean, I knew that there are various different relatively nearby pulsars that have been identified. Like Gamingo is one example. Gamingo
those
one?
Are much younger.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe you can discuss those data afterwards. But 2.4 sounds like it's good.
2.4 is quite good with huge air bars, probably.